Side 8. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 267. It does fit, Sparhawk said in a troubled voice. Would you ladies excuse me for a moment? I think Vanyan should hear this. It concerns him, too, and I'd like his advice before I start making decisions. He paused. Will you two be all right here? Together, I mean? Without someone here to keep you from each other's throats?
All will be well, Annika, Zanisha assured him. Divine Aphriel and I have something to discuss.
All right, he said, but no hitting. And don't start screaming at each other. You'll wake up the whole castle.
He crossed the parapet to the door and went back down the stairs. The meeting in the royal apartment had adjourned for a time, and Sparhawk found his friend sitting with his face in his hands in a room quite some distance from the one he normally shared with Sophronia.
"I need some help, my friend," Sparhawk said to him. "There's something you need to know, and we're going to have to decide what to do about it."
Venyan raised his grief-ravaged face.
"More trouble?" he asked. "Probably. Zanisha just told me. Well, I'll let her tell you about it herself. She and Danae are up at the top of the tower. I think we'll want to keep this private, at least until we decide what steps to take."
Vanyan nodded and rose to his feet. The two of them went back out into the corridor and started up the stairs.
"Where's Alasta?" Sparhawk asked.
"He's with Sophronia. She needs him right now."
Sparhawk grunted, not really trusting himself to speak. They found Zanisha and Danae at the battlements, looking out over the city. The sun was moving down the intensely blue autumn sky toward the craggy western horizon, and the breeze coming in off the Tamil Sea had a salt tang mingled with the ripe odor of autumn.
"All right, go ahead and tell him, Zanisha," Sparhawk said. "Then we'll decide what to do."
To Sparhawk's surprise, Vanyan didn't waste much time on incredulous exclamation.
"You're sure, Anaray?"
he asked after Zanisha had told him of Zalasta's duplicity. She nodded.
"I have seen his heart, my lord. He hath played thee false."
"You don't seem very surprised, Vanyan," Sparhawk said.
"I'm not. Well, not really. There's always been something about Zalasta that didn't quite ring true. He had some trouble keeping his face under control when Sophronia and I first went to Sarsos and moved into her house there. He tried to hide it, but I could tell that he wasn't very happy with our living arrangements, and his disapproval seemed to go quite a bit further than a generalized kind of moral outrage about unorthodox relationships."
"That's a delicate way to put it," Danae observed. "We've never understood why you humans make such a fuss about that. If two people love each other, they should do something about it. And living together is much more convenient for that sort of thing, isn't it?"
"There are certain ceremonies and formalities customary first," Sparhawk explained dryly.
"You mean something like the way the peacock shows off his feathers to the peahen before they start building a nest?"
"Something along those lines."
Vanyan sighed.
"It seems that Sophronia doesn't admire my feathers anymore."
"Not so, Lord Vanyan,"
Zanisha disagreed.
"She doth deeply love thee still, and her heart is made desolate by reason of her separation from thee."
"And Zalasta's with her right now, doing everything he can to make the separation permanent," Sparhawk added, his voice bleak. "How do you want us to proceed with this, Vanyan? You're the one most deeply involved here. There's nothing any of us could say that would convince Sophronia that Zalasta's a traitor, you know."
Vanyan nodded.
"She's going to have to see it for herself," he agreed. "How far were you able to reach into his mind, Anaray?"
"His present thought is open to me. his memories somewhat less so. Proximity and some time should provide opportunity to probe more.
That's the key, then, Vanyan said. Alana and Sarabian want to start tearing down the government almost immediately. Once that starts, Zelasta's presence in our inner councils is going to be potentially disastrous. He'll find out everything we've got planned.
Let him, Dennehy sniffed. It's not going to do him much good after I'm done with my supper.
What's this? Vanyan asked.
Our little savage here wants to eat Zelasta's heart, Sparhawk explained.
While he watches,
the child goddess added.
That's the whole point of it, making him watch while I do it.
Could she do that? Vanyan asked.
Probably, Sparhawk replied. I won't let her, though.
I didn't ask you, Father,
Dennehy said. You didn't have to. I said no. Now let's drop it.
When did Zelasta make this arrangement with Sirgon, Anaray?
Vanyan asked.
That is unclear for the nonce, my lord,
she replied.
I shall pursue it further. My sense of his thought doth suggest that their alliance dates back some years, and doth involve Belium in some fashion.
Sparhawk thought about that.
Zelasta was very upset when he found out that we'd thrown Belium into the sea, he recalled.
I could start making some educated guesses at this point, but let's wait and see what Zanisha is able to turn up. Right now, I think we'd better concentrate on delaying Alana and Sarabian until we can devise some way to make Zelasta expose his own guilt. We need to get Sophronia out from under his influence, and she's never going to believe that he's a traitor until she actually sees him convict himself by doing something that proves his treason.
Vanyan nodded his agreement.
I think we're going to have to keep this just among the four of us, Sparhawk continued. Zelasta's very shrewd, and Sophronia knows all of us better than we know ourselves. If the others have any idea of what we're doing, they'll let something slip, and Sophronia will know about it immediately. And Zelasta will know about 5 minutes after she does.
I'm afraid you're right,
Vanyan agreed.
Hast thou a plan, Annika?
Zanisha asked.
Sort of. I've still got to work out some of the details, though. It's a little complicated.
Dennehy rolled her eyes upward.
Aline's,
she sighed.
Absolutely not, Alana said adamantly. He's too valuable. We can't risk it.
She was sitting near the window with the morning sun streaming in on her and setting her pale hair aglow.
There's no risk involved, dear, Sparhawk assured her. The cloud and the shadow are both gone. Belium and I took care of that once and for all.
There was the flaw. Sparhawk was not entirely positive of that.
He's right, my queen, Kalton agreed. He tore the cloud to tatters and dissolved the shadow like salt in boiling water.
I'd really like to ask Kolata some questions, Alana,
Sarabian said.
It doesn't make sense to keep feeding him if we aren't going to get any use out of him. This is what we've been waiting for, my dear. Some sort of assurance that he won't be torn to pieces the minute he opens his mouth. Are you absolutely sure, Sparhawk?
Alana asked.
Trust me.
Sparhawk reached inside his doublet and took out the box.
My blue friend here can make sure that Kolata remains intact, no matter what questions we ask.
He looked at Zelasta.
I'm going to ask a favor of you, learned one, he said, keeping his voice casual. I think Sophronia should sit in on this. I know that she'd rather wash her hands of the lot of us, but maybe if she listens to Kolata's confession, she'll begin to take an interest in things again. It might be just the thing to bring her out of the state she's in right now.
Zelasta's face was troubled, though he was obviously trying very hard to keep his expression under control.
I don't think you realize how deeply she feels about this matter, Prince Sparhawk. I strongly advise you not to force her to be present when you question Kolata. It will only deepen the rift between her and her former friends.
I won't accept that, Zelasta, Elana told him. Sifrini is a member of the Royal Council of Alenia. I appointed her to that position when I ascended the throne. Her personal problems are her own business, but I need her here in her official capacity. If necessary, I'll command her presence, and I'll send Colton and Ulaf to deliver the command and make sure that she obeys. Sparhawk almost felt sorry for Zelasta at that point. Their decisions and their requests were all completely reasonable, and try though he might, Zelasta could find no way to avoid agreeing. Kolata's testimony was almost certain to be an absolute disaster for the first citizen of Styricum, but there was no way he could prevent that testimony without exposing himself as a traitor. He rose to his feet. "I will try to persuade her, Your Majesty," he said, bowing to Elana. He turned and quietly left the blue-draped room.
"I don't understand why you won't let us tell him, Sparhawk," Colton said. "He is a friend, after all."
"He's also a Styric, Colton," Vanyan said smoothly. "We don't know how he really feels about the Delphae. He might go up in flames if he finds out that Zanisha can pick his thoughts the way Talon picks pockets."
"Sifrini has probably told him about it already, Lord Vanyan," Vivier pointed out. Sparhawk threw a brief questioning look at Zanisha, framing the question in his thought. She shook her head. For some reason, Sifrinia had not yet told Zelasta about the Delphaic woman's strange capability to delve into the minds of others.
"I don't think so, Bevier," Vanyan was saying. "He hasn't shown any reluctance to be in the same room with the NRA, and that's a fair indication that he doesn't know. Now then, who's going to question Kolata? We should probably limit it to just one of us. If we all start throwing questions at him, his thoughts will be so jumbled that Zanisha won't be able to make any sense of them."
"Itanya's skilled at debate and disputation," Oscania suggested. "Academics spend hours splitting hairs."
"We prefer to call it meticulous attention to detail, old boy," Itanya corrected his brother. "Kolata has ministerial rank."
"Not anymore, he doesn't," Sarabian said.
"Well, he used to, Your Majesty. I'd suggest that we let Oscania conduct the interrogation. He holds the same rank as Kolata, so he'll be able to approach him as an equal."
"Might I make a suggestion?" Stragan asked.
"Of course, my Lord Stragan," the Emperor said.
"Teoven's been sneaking around out there, trying his very best to subvert the other ministries of Your Majesty's government. Wouldn't it be a good idea to make this a formal inquiry, instead of a Star Chamber proceeding? If all the ministers and the aides are present when we question Kolata, Teoven won't have the chance to scramble around and mend his fences."
"It's an interesting notion, isn't it, Elana?" Sarabian mused.
"Very interesting," she agreed. "We'll have to postpone the interrogation, though."
"Oh?"
"We'll want to give your Eitan runners a head start."
She looked at him gravely.
"This is it, Sarabian. Up until now, it's only been speculation. Once Kolata starts talking in front of the rest of the government, you'll be committed. Are you really ready to go that far?"
The Emperor drew in a deep breath.
"Yes, Elana, I think I am."
His voice was firm, but very quiet.
"Issue the order, then. Declare martial law. Turn the Eitans loose."
Sarabian swallowed hard. "Are you certain your idea will work, Eitan and Gessa?" he asked the towering warrior.
"It always has, Sarabian Emperor," and Gessa replied. "The signal fires are all in place. The word will spread throughout Tamale in a single night. The Eitans will move out of their garrisons the following morning."
Sarabian stared at the floor for a long time. Then he looked up. "Do it," he said. The difficult part was persuading Sarabian and Elana not to tell Zelasta about what was happening.
"He doesn't need to know," Sparhawk explained patiently.
"Surely you don't mistrust him, Sparhawk," Elana protested. "He's proved his loyalty over and over again.
Of course he has. He's a Styrek, though. And this sudden move of yours is going to turn all of Tomaly upside down. There's going to be absolute chaos out there. He may try to get word to the Styrek communities hereabouts. A warning of some kind. It's a natural thing for him to do, and we can't afford to risk letting that information get out. The only thing that makes your plan workable at all is the fact that it's going to be a total surprise. There are Styreks, and then there are Styreks. See what you mean, Sparhawk, Sarabian said in a testy voice. The term renegade Styrek means the same thing here in Tomaly as it does in Eosia, Your Majesty. We almost have to assume that if we tell Zelasta, we're telling all of Styrekum, don't we? We know Zelasta, but we don't know all the other Styreks on the continent. There are some in Sarsos who'd sign compacts with Hell itself if they thought it would give them a chance to get even with the Alenes.
You're going to hurt his feelings, you know,
Elana told him. He'll live. We only have one chance at this, so let's not take even the remotest of risks.
There was a polite tap at the door, and Mirtai stepped into the room where the three of them were meeting.
Uskanya and that other one are back, she reported.
Show them in, please, Etana, Sarabian told her. There was a kind of suppressed jubilation on the foreign minister's face as he entered with his brother, and Itanya's expression was almost identical. Sparhawk was a bit startled by how much alike they looked.
You two look like a couple of cats who just got into the cream, Sarabian told them.
We're pulling off the coup of the decade, Your Majesty,
Itanya replied.
Of the century, Uskanya corrected. Everything's in place, my emperor. We left it sort of vague. General meeting of the Imperial Council, that sort of thing.
Itanya dropped a few hints. He's been planting the notion that you're considering having your birthday declared a national holiday.
It's the sort of foolish whim Your Majesty's family is famous for.
Be nice, Sarabian murmured.
He had picked up that particular Alene expression during his stay in Elana's castle.
Sorry, Your Majesty, Uskanya apologized.
We've passed the whole thing off as a routine, meaningless meeting of the council. All formality and no substance.
May I borrow your throne room, Elana? Sarabian asked.
Of course. She smiled. Formal dress, I suppose?
Certainly. We'll wear our crowns and our state robes. You wear your prettiest dress, and I'll wear mine.
Your Majesty, Uskanya protested.
The customary Tamil mantle is hardly a dress. A long skirt is a long skirt, Uskanya. Frankly, I'd prefer doublet and hose. And, given the circumstances, my rapier. Stegan's right. Once you get used to wearing one, you start to feel undressed without it.
If formality's going to be the keynote, I think you and the others should wear your dress armor, Sparhawk, Elana told her husband.
Excellent idea, Elana, Sarabian approved. That way they'll be ready when things turn ugly.
They spent the rest of the day supervising the moving of furniture in the throne room. The Queen of Alenia, as she sometimes did, went to extremes.
Buntings? Sparhawk asked her. Buntings, Elana?
We want things to look festive, Sparhawk, she replied with an airy little toss of her head. Yes, I know. It's frivolous and even a little silly. But buntings hanging from the walls and trumpet fanfares introducing each of the ministers will set the tone. We want this to look so intensely formal that the government officials won't believe that anything serious could possibly happen. We're laying a trap, love, and buntings are part of the bait. Details, Sparhawk, details. Good plots swarm with details.
You're enjoying this, aren't you?
Of course I am. Is the drawbridge raised?
He nodded.
Good. Keep it that way. We don't want anybody slipping out of the castle with any kind of information. We'll escort the ministers inside tomorrow, and then we'll raise the drawbridge again. We want to be in absolute control of the situation.
Yes, dear.
Don't make fun of me, Sparhawk, she warned.
I'd sooner die.
It was nearly dusk when Zelasta came into the throne room and took Sparhawk to one side.
I must leave, Prince Sparhawk, he pleaded, his eyes a little wild. It is a matter of the gravest urgency.
My hands are tied, Zelasta, Sparhawk replied. You know my wife. When she starts speaking in the royal we, there's no reasoning with her. There are things I must set in motion, Your Highness, things vital to the success of the Emperor's plan. I'll try to talk with her, but I can't hold out much hope. Things are fairly well under control, though. The Etons know what to do outside the castle walls, and my church knights can handle things inside. There are ministers and other high-level officials whose loyalty is in doubt, you know. We don't know exactly what the questioning of the Minister of the Interior is going to bring out. We'll have those people in our hands, and we don't want them running off to stir up more mischief.
You don't understand, Sparhawk.
The note of desperation was clearly evident. I'll do what I can, Zelasta, Sparhawk said, but I can't make any promises. Chapter 19. The Tamil architect who had designed Aelana's castle had evidently devoted half a lifetime to the study of Aline buildings, and, like so many with limited gifts, he had slavishly imitated the details without capturing the spirit. The throne room was a case in point. Aline castles have but two purposes, to remain standing and to keep out unwanted visitors. Both these purposes are served best by the kind of massive construction one might consider in designing a mountain. Over the centuries, some Alines have sought to soften their necessarily bleak surroundings by embellishment. The interior braces intended to keep the walls from collapsing, even when swept by a blizzard of boulders, became buttresses. The massive stone posts, designed to keep the ceiling where it belonged, became columns with ornately carved bases and capitals. The same sort of strength can be achieved by vaulting, and the throne room of Aelana's Tamil-built castle was a marvel of redundancy. It was massively vaulted and supported by long rows of fluted columns, and was braced by flying buttresses so delicate as to be not only useless, but actually hazardous to those standing under them. Moreover, like everything else in fire-domed Mytherian, the entire room was sheathed in opalescent mother-of-pearl. Aelana had chosen the buntings with some care, and the gleaming walls were now accented with a riot of color. The 40-foot-long blue velvet draperies at the narrow windows had been accented with white satin. The walls were decorated with crossed pennons and imitation battle flags. Bright runners carpeted the aisles, and the columns and buttresses were bandaged with scarlet silk. The place looked to Sparhawk's somewhat jaundiced eye like a country fair operated by a profoundly color-blind entrepreneur.
Garish,
Uloth observed, buffing the black ogre horns on his helmet with a piece of cloth.
Garish comes close, Sparhawk agreed.
Sparhawk wore his formal black armor and silver surcoat. The Tamil blacksmith, who had hammered out the dents and re-enameled the armor, had also anointed the inside of each intricately wrought section, and all the leather straps, with crushed rose petals, in a kind of subtle, unspoken criticism of the armor's normal fragrance. The resulting mixture of odors was peculiar.
How are we going to explain all the guards standing around Aelana and Sarabian?
Uloth asked.
We don't have to explain things, Uloth.
Sparhawk shrugged.
We're Alines, and the rest of the world believes that we're barbarians with strange ritualistic customs that nobody else understands. I am not going to let my wife sit there unprotected while she and Sarabian calmly advise the Tamil government that it's been dismantled.
Good thinking.
Uloth looked gravely at his friend.
Sofrini is being difficult, you know.
We more or less expected that.
She might have an easier time if she could sit next to Zelasta.
Sparhawk shook his head.
Zelasta's an advisor to the government. He'll have to be on the main floor with the ministers. Let's keep Sofrenia off to one side. I'll have Danae sit with her.
That might help. Your daughter's presence seems to calm Sofrenia.
I wouldn't seat Zanisha with them, though. I hadn't planned to.
Just making sure. Did Engesa get any kind of acknowledgement of his signal? Are we absolutely sure his order got to everybody?
He is. I guess the Etons have used signal fires to pass orders along for centuries.
I'm just a bit dubious about bonfires on hilltops as a way to send messages, Sparhawk.
That's Engesa's department. It won't matter all that much if word hadn't reached a few backwaters by sunrise this morning.
You're probably right. I guess we've done all we can, then. I just hope nothing goes wrong.
What could go wrong?
That's the kind of thinking that fills graveyards, Sparhawk. I'll go tell them to lower the drawbridge. We might as well get started.
Strachan had carefully coached the dozen Tommel trumpeters and the rest of his musicians, concluding the lesson with some horrendous threats and an instructional visit to the carefully recreated torture chamber in the basement. The musicians had all piously sworn to play the proper notes and to forego improvisation. The fanfares that were to greet the arrival of each minister of the imperial government had been Aelana's idea. Fanfares are flattering. They elevate the ego. They lull the unwary into traps. Aelana was good at that sort of thing. The depths of her political instincts sometimes amazed Sparhawk. In keeping with the formality of the occasion, armored church knights were stationed at evenly spaced intervals along the walls. To the casual observer, the knights were no more than a part of the decor of the throne room. The casual observer, however, would have been wrong. The motionless men in steel were there to make absolutely certain that once the members of the imperial government had entered the room, they would not leave without permission. And the drawbridge, which was to be raised as soon as all the guests had arrived, doubly ensured that nobody would grow bored and wander off. Sarabian had advised his Aline friends that the Imperial Council of Tomali had grown over the centuries. At first, the council had consisted only of the ministers. Then the ministers had included their secretaries. Then their undersecretaries. By now it had reached the point where sub-sub-assistant temporary interim undersecretaries were also included. The title Member of the Imperial Council had become largely meaningless. The inclusion of such a mob, however, ensured that every traitor inside the imperial compound would be gathered under Aelana's battlements. The Queen of Alenia was shrewd enough to even use her enemies' egotism as a weapon against them. "Well?" Aelana asked nervously, when her husband entered the royal apartment. The Queen of Alenia wore a cream-colored gown, trimmed with gold lamé, and a dark blue, ermine-trimmed velvet cloak. Her crown looked quite delicate, a kind of lace cap made of hammered gold, inset with bright-colored gems. Despite its airy appearance, however, Sparhawk knew, because he had picked it up several times, that it was almost as heavy as her state crown, which was locked in the royal vault back in Samura. "They're starting to drift across the drawbridge," he reported. "Itania's greeting them. He knows everybody of any consequence in the government, so he'll know when our guests have all arrived. As soon as everyone's inside, the knights will raise the drawbridge." He looked at Emperor Sarabian, who stood near a window, nervously chewing on one fingernail. "It's not going to be all that much longer, Your Majesty," he said. "Shouldn't you change clothes?" "The Tommel mantle was designed to cover a multitude of defects, Prince Barhawk, so it should cover my western clothes. And my rapier. I am not going in there unarmed."
"We'll take care of you, Sarabian," Aelana assured him.
"I'd rather do it myself, Mother." The Emperor suddenly laughed nervously. "A bad joke, perhaps, but there's a lot of truth to it. You've raised me from political babyhood, Aelana. In that respect, you are my mother."
"If you ever call me Mommy, I'll never speak to you again, Your Majesty."
"I'd sooner bite out my tongue, Your Majesty."
"What's the customary procedure, Your Majesty?" Sparhawk asked Sarabian as they stood peering around the edge of the draped doorway into the rapidly filling throne room.
"As soon as everybody gets here, Subhat will call the meeting to order," Sarabian replied. "That's when I enter, usually to the sound of what passes for music here in Mytherian."
"Strahan's seen to it that your grand entrance will be truly grand," Aelana assured him. "He composed the fanfare himself."
"Are all Aline thieves artists?" Sarabian asked. "Talon paints, Strahan composes music, and Kaalador's a gifted actor."
"We do seem to attract talent, don't we?"
Aelana smiled. "Should I explain why there are so many of us on the dais?"
Sarabian asked, glancing at Mirtai and Engesa.
She shook her head. Never explain. It's a sign of weakness. I'll enter on your arm, and they'll all grovel.
It's called genuflectory prostration, Aelana.
Whatever.
She shrugged.
When they get up again, we'll be sitting there with our guards around us. That's when you take over the meeting. Don't even let Subot get started. We've got our own agenda today, and we don't have time to listen to him babble about the prospects for the wheat harvest on the plains of Edom. How are you feeling?
Nervous. I've never overthrown a government before.
Neither have I, actually. Unless you count what I did in the Basilica when I appointed Dolmont to the Archprelacy.
She didn't actually do that, did she, Sparhawk?
Oh, yes, Your Majesty. All by herself. She was superb.
Just keep talking, Sarabian, Aelana told him. If anyone tries to interrupt, shout him down. Don't even pretend to be polite. This is your party. Don't be conciliatory or reasonable. Be coldly furious instead. Are you any good at oratory?
Probably not. They don't let me speak in public very often, except at the graduation ceremonies at the university.
Speak slowly. You tend to talk too fast. Half of any good oration lies in its cadence. Use pauses. Vary your volume from a shout down to a whisper. Be dramatic. Give them a good show.
He laughed. You're a charlatan, Aelana.
Naturally. That's what politics is all about. Fraud, deceit, charlatanism.
That's dreadful.
Of course. That's why it's so much fun.
The brazen fanfares echoed back from the vaulted ceiling as each minister entered the throne room, and they had the desired effect. The ministers in their silken mantles all seemed slightly awed by their own sublime importance. They moved to their places with stately pace and slow, their expressions grave, even exalted. Pandya Subot, the Prime Minister, seemed particularly impressed with himself. He sat splendidly alone in a crimson upholstered chair, to one side of the dais upon which the throne stood, looking out imperially at the other officials assembling in the chairs lining both sides of the broad central aisle. Chancellor of the Exchequer Gashon sat with Teoven, the Director of the Secret Police, and several other ministers. There seemed to be a great deal of whispering going on in the little group.
That would probably be the opposition, Aelana observed. Teoven's certainly involved, and the others are also most likely a part of it, to a greater or lesser degree.
She turned to Talon, who stood directly behind her, wearing his page's knee breeches.
Pay very close attention to that group, she instructed. I want a report on their reactions. We should be able to determine their degree of guilt by the looks on their faces.
Yes, my queen.
Then Itania appeared briefly at the massive double doors to the throne room and flicked his hand at Ulof, signaling that all of the relevant officials had arrived. Ulof, who stood to one side of the dais, nodded and raised his ogre-horn trumpet to his lips. The room seemed to shudder into a shocked silence as the barbaric sound of the ogre-horn, deep-toned and rasping, reverberated from the nacreous walls. The huge doors boomed shut, and two armored knights, one a Serenic all in white, and the other a Pandian all in black, placed themselves in front of the entryway. The Prime Minister rose to his feet. Ulof banged the butt of his axe on the floor three times to call for silence. The Emperor winced.
What's wrong, Sarabian?
Mirtai asked him.
Sir Ulof just broke several of the floor tiles.
We can replace them with bone, she assured him. There should be quite a few lying around before the day's over.
Will the council please come to order? Pandya Subot intoned.
Ulof banged the floor again. Sparhawk looked around the throne room. Everyone was in place. Sifrinia, dressed in her white styric robe, sat with Princess Danae and Kaalador on the far side of the room. Zanisha, also in white, sat on the near side with Calton and Barrett. Melodir sat in a small gallery with the nine imperial wives. The clever baroness had carefully cultivated a friendship with Sarabian's first wife, Sierona, a member of one of the noblest houses of Tommel proper, and the mother of the crown prince. The friendship had by now grown so close that Melodir was customarily invited to attend state functions in the company of the empresses.
Her presence among them this time had a serious purpose, however. Sarabian had a wife from each of the 9 kingdoms, and it was entirely possible that some of them had been subverted. Sparhawk was fairly certain that the bare-breasted Valesian, Elisun, was free of any political contamination. She was simply too busy for politics. The Tegan wife, Gahinus, a puritanical lady obsessed with her personal virtue and her staunch republicanism, would probably not have even been approached by conspirators. Torellia of Arjuna and Chakol of Seneska, however, were highly suspect. They had both established what might best be called personal courts, liberally sprinkled with nobles from their homelands. Melodir had been instructed to keep a close eye on those two in particular for signs of unusual reactions to the revelation of Zelasta's true affiliation. Sparhawk sighed. It was all so complicated. Friends and enemies all looked the same. In the long run, it might turn out that Zanisha's unusual gift would prove more valuable than a sudden offer of aid from an entire army. Vanyan, who had unobtrusively stationed himself with the knights lining the walls, reached up and first lowered, then raised his visor. It was the signal that all their forces were in place. Stragan, who was with his trumpeters behind the dais, nodded briefly in acknowledgement. Then Sparhawk looked rather closely at Zelasta, the unknowing guest of honor at this affair. Hysteric, his eyes apprehensive, sat among the ministers, his white robe looking oddly out of place among all the bright-colored silk mantles. He quite obviously knew that something was afoot, and just as obviously had no idea what it might be. That was something, anyway. At least no one in the inner circle had been subverted. Sparhawk irritably shook that thought off. Under the circumstances, a certain amount of wary suspicion was only natural. But left unchecked, it could become a disease. He made a sour face. About one more day of this, and he'd begin to suspect himself. "The council will now come to order," Pandya Subhat repeated. Ulaf broke some more tiles. "By command of His Imperial Majesty Emperor Sarabian, this council is called to order." "Good God, Subhat," Sarabian groaned, half to himself. "Will you destroy the floor entirely?" "Gentlemen, His Imperial Majesty Sarabian of Tamale." A single trumpet voiced a clear, ringing theme of majestically descending notes. Then another joined the first to repeat the theme a third of an octave higher. Then another trumpet, another third higher. Then, in a great crescendo, and still higher, the musicians all joined in to fill the throne room with shimmering echoes. "Impressive," Sarabia noted. "Do we go in now?"
"Not yet," Elana told him. "The music changes. That's when we start. Pay attention to my hand on your arm. Let me set the pace. Don't jump when we get to the thrones. Stragan's got a whole brass band hidden in various parts of the room. The climax will be thunderous. Draw yourself up. Throw your shoulders back. And look regal. Try your very best to look like a god."
"Are you having fun, Elana?"
She grinned impishly at him and winked.
"There," she said. "The flutes at the back of the hall have picked up the theme. That's our signal. Good luck, my friend."
She kissed him lightly on the cheek, and then laid her hand on his arm.
"One,"
she said, listening intently to the music.
"Two."
She drew in a deep breath.
"Now."
And the Emperor of Tamale and the Queen of Alenia stepped through the archway and crossed with regal pace toward their golden thrones as the flutes at the rear of the hall softly sang the plaintive accompaniment of Stragan's main theme, set now in a minor key. Immediately behind them came Sparhawk, Mirtai, and Gessa, and Bevier. Talon, Aileen, and Itania, who was still puffing slightly from running through the halls, followed. As the royal party reached the thrones, Stragan, who was using his rapier as a conductor's baton, led his hidden musicians into a fortissimo recapitulation of his main theme. The sound was overwhelming. It was not entirely certain whether the members of the Imperial Council fell to their faces out of habit, or were knocked down by that enormous blast of sound. Stragan cut his rapier sharply to one side, and the musicians broke off, slashed as it were into silence, leaving the echoes shimmering in the air like ghosts. Pandya Subhat rose to his feet.
"Will Your Majesty address some few remarks to this assemblage before we commence?"
he asked, in an almost insultingly superior tone. The question was sheer formality, almost ritualistic. The Emperor traditionally did not speak at these sessions. "Why, yes, as a matter of fact, I believe I will, Pandya Subhat," Sarabian replied, rising again to his feet. "So good of you to ask, old boy." Subhat gaped at him, his expression incredulous. "But was there something, Subhat?"
"This is most irregular, Your Majesty."
"I know. Refreshing, isn't it? We've got a lot to cover today, Subhat, so let's get cracking."
"Your Majesty has not consulted with me. We cannot proceed if I don't know what the issues are."
"Sit, Subhat," Sarabian snapped. "Stay." His tone was one of command. "You will remain silent until I give you leave to speak."
"You can't..."
"I said sit down." Subhat quailed and sank into his chair. "Your head's none too tightly attached just now, my Lord Prime Minister," Sarabian said ominously. "And if you waggle it at me in the wrong way, it might just fall off. You've been tiptoeing right on the brink of treason, Pandya Subhat, and I'm more than a little put out with you." The Prime Minister's face went deathly pale. Sarabian began to pace up and down on the dais, his face like a thundercloud.
"Please, God, make him stand still," Elana said under her breath. "He can't make a decent speech if he's loping around the dais like a gazelle in flight."
Then the Emperor stopped to stand at the very front of the slightly elevated platform. "I'm not going to waste time with banalities, gentlemen," he told his government bluntly. "We had a crisis, and I depended on you to deal with it. You failed me, probably because you were too busy playing your usual games of politics. The Empire required giants, and all I had to serve me were dwarves. That made it necessary for me to deal with the crisis personally. And that's what I've been doing, gentlemen, for the past several months. You are no longer relevant, my lords. I am the government." There were cries of outrage from the ministers and their subordinates.
"He's going too fast," Elana exclaimed. "He should have built up to that."
"Don't be such a critic," Sparhawk told her. "It's his speech. Let him make it his own way."
"I will have silence," Sarabian declared. The council paid no attention. They continued their excited babbling. The Emperor opened his mantle to reveal his Aline clothing, and then he drew his rapier.
"I said silence!"
he roared. All sound ceased. "I'll pin the next man who interrupts me to the wall like a butterfly," Sarabian told them. Then he cut his rapier sharply through the air. The whistling sound of the blade's passage was as chill as death itself. He looked around at his cowed officials. "That's a little better," he said. "Now stay that way." He set the point of the rapier on the floor and lightly crossed his hands on the pommel. "My family has depended on the ministries to handle the day-to-day business of government for centuries," he said. "Our trust has obviously been misplaced. You were adequate, barely, in times of tranquility. But when a crisis arose, you began to scurry around like ants, more interested in protecting your fortunes, your personal privileges, and perpetuating your petty interdepartmental rivalries than in the good of my empire. And that's the one thing you all seem to forget, gentlemen. It's my empire. My family hasn't made a great issue of the fact, but I think it's time you were reminded of it. You serve me, and you serve only at my pleasure, not at your convenience." The officials were all gaping at the man they had thought to be no more than a harmless eccentric. Sparhawk saw a movement near the middle of the throne room. His eyes flicked back to the front, and he saw that Teoban's chair was conspicuously empty. The director of the secret police was more clever and much quicker than his colleagues, and, throwing dignity to the winds, he was busily crawling on his hands and knees toward the nearest exit. Chancellor of the Exchequer Gashon, thin, bloodless, and wispy-haired, sat beside Teoban's vacant chair, staring at Sarabian in open terror. Sparhawk looked quickly at Vanyan, and the preceptor nodded. Vanyan had seen the crawling policeman, too. "When I perceived that I had chosen little men with little minds to administer my empire," Sarabian was saying, "I appealed to Zelasta of Styricum for advice. Who better to deal with the supernatural than the Styrics?
It was Zelasta who recommended that I submit a request directly to Archprelate Dolmont of the Church of Kyrellos for assistance, and the very core of that assistance was to be Prince Sparhawk of Alenia. We Tamils pride ourselves on our subtlety and our sophistication, but I assure you that we are but children when compared to the Alenes. The state visit of my dear sister Elana was little more than a subterfuge designed to conceal the fact that our main purpose was to bring her husband, Sir Sparhawk, to Matherion. Queen Elana and I amused ourselves by deceiving you, and you were not hard to deceive, my lords, while Prince Sparhawk and his companions sought the roots of the turmoil here in Tamale. As we had anticipated, our enemies reacted. There was a brief, muted disturbance at one of the side doors. Vanyan and Khalad were quite firmly preventing the director of the secret police from leaving. "Did you have a pressing engagement somewhere, Teoban?" Sarabian drawled. Teoban's eyes were wild, and he looked at his emperor with open hatred. "If you're discontent with me, Teoban, I'll be more than happy to give you satisfaction," Sarabian told him, flourishing his rapier meaningfully. "Please return to your seat. My seconds will call upon you when we've concluded here." Vanyan took the director of the secret police by one arm, turned him around, and pointed at the empty seat. Then, with a none too gentle shove, he started him moving. "This windy preamble's beginning to bore me, gentlemen," Sarabian announced, "so why don't we get down to cases? The attempted coup here in Matherion was the direct response to Sir Sparhawk's arrival. The assorted disturbances which have kept the Aetons running from one end of the continent to the other for the past several years have had one source, and only one. We have a single enemy, and he has formed a massive conspiracy designed to overthrow the government and to wrest my throne from me, and, as I probably should have anticipated, given the nature of those who pretend to serve me, he had willing helpers in the government itself." Some of the dignitaries gasped. Others looked guilty. "Pay very close attention, gentlemen," Sarabian told them. "This is where it gets interesting. Many of you have wondered at the long absence of Interior Minister Colata. I'm sure you'll be delighted to know that Colata is going to be joining us now." He turned to Ulot. "Would you be so good as to invite the Minister of the Interior to come in, Sir Knight?" he asked. Ulot bowed, and Colton rose from his seat to join him. "Minister Colata, as the chief policeman in all the Empire, knows a great deal about criminal activities," Sarabian declared. "I'm absolutely sure that his analysis of the present situation will be enlightening." Colton and Uloth returned with the ashen-faced Minister of the Interior between them. It was not the fact that Colata was in obvious distress that raised the outcry from the other officials, however, but rather the fact that the chief policeman of the Empire was in chains. Emperor Sarabian stood impassively as his council members shouted their protests. "How am I doing so far, Elana?" he asked out of the corner of his mouth. "I'd have done it differently," she told him. "But that's only a matter of style. I'll give you a complete critique when it's all over." She looked out at the officials who were all on their feet talking excitedly. "Don't let that go on for too long. Remind them who's in charge. Be very firm about it." "Yes, Mother." He smiled. Then he looked at his government and drew in a deep breath. "Quiet!" he roared in a great voice. They fell into a stunned silence. "There will be no further interruptions of these proceedings," Sarabian told them. "The rules have changed, gentlemen. We're not going to pretend to be civilized anymore. I'm going to tell you what to do, and you're going to do it. I'd like to remind you that not only do you serve at my pleasure, you also continue to live only at my pleasure. The Minister of the Interior is guilty of high treason. You'll note that there was no trial. Colata is guilty because I say that he's guilty." Sarabian paused as a new realization came to him. "My power in Tamale is absolute. I am the government, and I am the law. We are going to question Colata rather closely. Pay attention to his answers, gentlemen. Your positions in government, your very lives, may hinge on what he says. Foreign Minister Oscania is going to question Colata, not about his guilt, which has already been established, but about the involvement of others. We are going to get to the bottom of this once and for all. You may proceed, Oscania."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
Oscania rose to his feet and stood a moment in deep thought, as Sarabian sat again on his throne. Buscagna wore a black silk mantle. His choice of color had been quite deliberate. While black mantles were not common, they were not unheard of. Judges and imperial prosecutors, however, always wore black. The somber color heightened the foreign minister's pallor, which in turn accentuated his grim expression. Khalad came forward with a plain wooden stool and set it down in front of the dais. Kaltan and Uloth brought the minister of the interior forward and plopped him unceremoniously down on the stool. "Do you understand your situation here, Kolata?" Oscania asked the prisoner.
"You have no right to question me, Oscania," Kolata replied quickly.
"Break his fingers, Khalad," Sparhawk instructed from his position just behind Aelana's throne.
"Yes, my lord," Khalad replied. "How many?"
"Start out with one or two. Every time he starts talking about Oscania's rights, or his own, break another one."
"Yes, my lord."
Khalad took the interior minister's wrist.
"Stop him," Kolata squealed in fright. "Somebody stop him."
"Kaltan, Ula," Sparhawk said, "kill the first man who moves." Kaltan drew his sword, and Uloth raised his axe. "You see how it is, old boy," Oscania said to the man on the stool. "You're not universally loved to begin with, and Prince Sparhawk's command has just evaporated any minuscule affection anyone here might have had for you. You will talk, Kolata. Sooner or later, you'll talk. We can do this the easy way, or we can do it the other way. But you are going to answer my questions." Oscania's expression had become implacable.
"They'll kill me, Oscania," Kolata pleaded. "They'll kill me if I talk."
"You're in a difficult situation then, Kolata, because we'll kill you if you don't. You're taking orders from Sirgon, aren't you?"
"Sirgon? That's absurd," Kolata blustered. "Sirgon's a myth."
"Oh, really?" Oscania looked at him with contempt. "Don't play the fool with me, Kolata. I don't have the patience for it. Your orders come from the Senescan embassy, don't they? And most of the time they're delivered by a man named Krager." Kolata gaped at him. "Close your mouth, Kolata. You look like an idiot with it hanging open like that. We already know a great deal about your treason. All we really want from you are a few details. You were first contacted by someone you had reason to trust, and most probably someone you respected. That immediately rules out a Senescan. No Tamil has anything but contempt for Senescans. Given our characteristic sense of our own superiority, that would also rule out an Arjunai or an Aline from any of the Western kingdoms. That would leave only another Tamil, or possibly an Etan. Or—" Oscania's eyes suddenly widened, and his expression grew thunderstruck. "Or a Styric."
"Absurd,"
Kolata scoffed weakly. His eyes, however, were wild, darting this way and that like those of a man looking for a place to hide. Sparhawk looked appraisingly at Zelasta. The sorcerer's face was deathly pale, but his eyes showed that he was still in control. It was going to take something more to push him over the edge. The big Pandian placed his left hand on his sword hilt, giving Oscania their prearranged signal. "We don't seem to be getting anywhere, old boy," Oscania drawled, recovering from his surprise. "I think you need some encouragement." He turned and looked at Zanisha. "Would you be so kind, Anaray?" he asked her. "Our esteemed Minister of the Interior doesn't seem to want to share things with us. Do you suppose you could persuade him to change his mind?"
"I can but try, Oscania of Mathirion," Zanisha replied, rising to her feet.
She crossed the front of the room, choosing for some reason to approach the prisoner from the side where Sophronia sat, rather than the one from which she herself had been watching.
"Thou art afeared, Kolata of Mathirion," she said gravely. "And thy fear doth make thee brave, for it is in thy mind that though they who hold thy body captive may do thee great harm, he who hath thy soul in thrall may do thee worse. Now must thou contend with yet an even greater fear. Look upon me, Colata of Mithurion, and tremble, for I will visit upon thee the ultimate horror. Wilt thou speak, and speak freely?
I can't, Colata wailed.
Then art thou lost. Behold me as I truly am, and consider well thy fate. For I am death, Colata of Mithurion, death beyond thy most dreadful imagining.
The color drained from her slowly, and the glow within her was faint at first. She stood looking at him with her chin raised, and an expression of deep sadness in her eyes, as she glowed brighter and brighter. Colata screamed. The other officials scrambled to their feet, their faces terrified, and their babbling suddenly shrill.
"Sit down!" Sarabian bellowed at them. "And be silent!"
A few of them were cowed into obedience. Most, however, were too frightened. They continued to shrink back from Zanisha, crying out in shrill voices.
"My Lord Vanyan," Sarabian called over the tumult, "would you please restore order?" "At once, Your Majesty."
Vanyan clapped down his visor, pulled his sword from its scabbard, and raised his shield.
"Draw swords!"
He barked the command. There was a steely rasp as the church knights drew their swords.
"Forward!"
Vanyan ordered. The knights posted along the walls marched clankingly forward, their swords at the ready, converging on the frightened officials. Vanyan stretched forth his steel-clad arm, extending his sword and touching the tip to the throat of the Prime Minister.
"The Emperor told you to sit down, Pandya Subbat," he said. "Do it! Now!"
The Prime Minister sank back into his chair, suddenly more afraid of Vanyan than he was of Zanisha. A couple of the council members had to be chased down and forcibly returned to their seats, and one rather athletic one, the Minister of Public Works, Sparhawk thought, was only persuaded to come down from the drape he'd been climbing by the threat of Khalad's crossbow. Order was restored. When the council had returned, or been returned, to their seats, however, the Chancellor of the Exchequer was discovered lying on the floor, vacant-eyed and with a large bubble of foam protruding from his gaping mouth. Vanyan checked the body rather perfunctorily.
"Poison," he said shortly. "He seems to have taken it himself."
Elana shuddered. "Prithee, Enere," Sarabian said to Zanisha, "continue thine inquiry."
"An it please your majesty," she replied in that strange echoing voice.
She turned her gaze on Colata.
"Wilt thou speak, and freely, Colata of Mithurion?"
she asked. He shrank back in horror.
"So be it, then."
She put forth her hand and moved closer.
"The curse of Edamus is upon me,"
she warned,
"and I bear its mark. I will share that curse with thee. Mayhap thou wilt regret thy silence, when thy flesh doth decay and melt like wax from thy bones. The time hath come to choose, Colata of Mithurion. Speak or die. Who is it who hath stolen thy loyalty from thine appointed master?"
Her hand, more surely deadly than Vanyan's sword, was within inches of Colata's ashen face.
"No!" he shrieked. "No, I'll tell you."
The cloud appeared quite suddenly in the air above the gibbering minister, but Sparhawk was ready. Half hidden behind Elana's throne, he had taken off his gauntlet and surreptitiously removed the sapphire rose from its confinement. "Blue rose," he said sharply, "destroy the cloud." The bellium surged in his hand, and the dense, almost solid-appearing patch of intense darkness tattered, whipping like a pennon on a flagstaff in a hurricane. Then it streamed away and was gone. Zelasta was thrown back in his chair as his spell was broken. He half rose and fell back again, writhing and moaning as the jagged edges of his broken spell clawed at him. His chair overturned, and he convulsed on the floor like one caught in a seizure.
"It was him!" Colata shrieked, pointing with a trembling hand. "It was Zelasta! He made me do it!"
Sophronia's gasp was clearly audible. Sparhawk looked sharply at her. She had fallen back, nearly as shaken as Alasta himself. Her eyes were filled with disbelief and horror. Danae, Sparhawk noticed, was talking to her, speaking rapidly and holding her sister's face quite firmly in her small hands.
"Curse you, Sparhawk!"
The words came out in a kind of rasping croak, as Zelasta, aided by his staff, dragged himself unsteadily to his feet. His face was shaken and twisted in frustration and rage.
"You are mine, Sophronia! Mine!" he howled. "I have longed for you for an eternity, watched as your thieving gutter-snipe goddess stole you from me. But no more! Thus do I banish forever the child goddess and her hold on thee."
His deadly staff whirled and leveled.
"Die, Afriel!" he shrieked.
Sophronia, without even thinking, clasped her arms around Sparhawk's daughter and turned quickly in her seat, shielding the little girl with her own body, willingly offering her back to Zelasta's fury. Sparhawk's heart froze as a ball of fire shot from the tip of his staff.
"No!"
Vanyan cried, trying to rush forward. But Zanisha was already there. Her decision to approach Kolata from Sophronia's side of the room had clearly been influenced by her perception of what lay in Zelasta's mind. She had consciously placed herself in a position to protect her enemy. Unafraid, she faced the raving Styrek. The sizzling fireball streaked through the silent air of the throne room, bearing with it all of Zelasta's centuries-old hatred. Zanisha held out her hand, and, like a tame bird returning to the hand that feeds it, the flaming orb settled into that hand. With only the faint hint of a smile touching her lips, the Delphaic woman closed her fingers around Zelasta's pent-up hatred. For an instant, incandescent flames spurted out from between her pale fingers, and then she absorbed the fiery messenger of death, the light within her consuming it utterly.
"What now, Zelasta of Styrakum?"
she asked the raging sorcerer.
"What dost thou propose now? Wilt thou contend with me more at peril of thy life? Or wilt thou, like the whipped cur thou art, cringe and flee my wrath? For I do know thee. It hath been thy poisoned tongue which hath set my sister's heart against me. Flee, master of lies! Abuse Sophronia's ears no longer with thy foul slanders. Go, I abjure thee. Go."
Zelasta howled, and in that howl there was a lifetime of unsatisfied longing and blackest despair. And then he vanished. Chapter 20. Emperor Sarabian's expression was strangely detached as he looked out over the shambles of his government. Some of the officials appeared to be in shock, others scurried aimlessly, babbling. Several were clustered at the main door, imploring the knights to let them out. Oscania, his diplomat's face imperturbable, approached the dais. "Surprising turn of events," he noted, as if he were speaking of an unexpected summer shower. He studiously adjusted his black mantle, looking more and more like a judge. "Yes," Sarabian agreed, his eyes still lost in thought. "I think we might be able to exploit it, however. Sparhawk, is that dungeon down in the basement functional?"
"Yes, Your Majesty. The architect was very thorough."
"Good. What have you got in mind, Sarabian?" Elana asked him. He grinned at her, his face suddenly almost boyish.
"I ain't a-tellin', Dorlan," he replied, in outrageous imitation of Kaalador's dialect. "I purely wouldn't want to spoil the surprise."
"Please, Sarabian," she said with a weary sigh. "Just you watch, your queenship. I'm a-fixin' to pull off a little coup my own self." "You're going to make me cross, Sarabian. Don't you love me any more, mother?"
His tone was excited and exhilarated.
"Men," she said, rolling her eyes upward.
"Just follow my lead, my friends," the Emperor told them. "Let's find out how well I've learned my lessons." He rose to his feet.
"Lord Vanyan," he called, "would you be so good as to return our guests to their seats?"
"At once, Your Majesty," Vanyan replied.
Vanyan, forewarned of Zelasta's treachery, was completely in control. He barked a few short commands, and the church knights firmly escorted the distracted officials back to their chairs.
"What was he doing?"
Elana demanded of her husband in a tense whisper.
"Why did he try to attack Danny?"
"He didn't, love," Sparhawk replied, thinking very quickly. "He was trying to attack Afriel. Didn't you see her? She was standing right beside Sophrenia."
"She was?"
"Of course. I thought everyone in the room saw her, but maybe it was only me. And Zelasta. Why do you think he ran away so fast? Afriel was right on the verge of jerking out his heart and eating it before his very eyes." She shuddered. Emperor Sarabian moved to the front of the dais again.
"Let's come to order, gentlemen," he told them crisply. "We haven't finished here yet. I gather that you were surprised by the revelation of Zelasta's true position. Some of you, anyway. I'm disappointed in you, my lords. Most of you for your profound lack of perception. The rest for not realizing that I could see through Zelasta, and you, like panes of glass. Some of you are traitors. The rest are merely stupid. I have no need of men of either stripe in my service. It is my excruciating pleasure to announce that at sunrise this morning, the Aton garrisons throughout Kamali moved out of their barracks and replaced all Imperial authorities with officers from their own ranks. With the exception of Mithyrian, the entire Empire is under martial law."
They gaped at him.
"Aton and Gessa?" Sarabian said.
"Yes, Sarabian Emperor."
"Would you be so kind as to eliminate that lone exception? Take your Aetons out into the city and take charge of the capital."
"At once, Sarabian Emperor."
And Gessa's grin was very broad.
"Be firm, Engessa. Show my subjects my fist."
"It shall be as you command, Sarabian Emperor."
"Splendid chap," Sarabian murmured loudly enough to be heard, as the towering Aton marched to the door.
"Your Majesty," Pandya Subot protested weakly, half rising.
The look the Emperor gave his Prime Minister was icy. "I'm busy right now, Subot," he said. "You and I will talk later, extensively. I'm sure I'll find your explanation of how all of this happened under your very nose, without even disturbing your decades-long nap, absolutely fascinating. Now sit down and be quiet."
The Prime Minister sank back into his chair, his eyes very wide.
"All of Tamale is under martial law now," the Emperor told his officials. "Since you failed so miserably, I've been obliged to step in and take charge. That makes you redundant, so you are all dismissed."
There were gasps, and some of the officials, those longest in office and most convinced of their own near divinity, cried out in protest.
"Moreover," Sarabian cut across their objections, "the treason of Zelasta has cast doubt upon the loyalty of each and every one of you. If I cannot trust all, I must suspect all. I want you to search your souls tonight, gentlemen, because we'll be asking you questions tomorrow, and we'll want complete truth from you. We don't have time for lies or excuses, or attempts to wriggle out from under your responsibility or guilt. I strongly recommend that you be forthcoming. The consequences of mendacity or evasion will be very unpleasant."
Ulof took a long honing steel from his belt and began to draw it slowly across the edge of his axe blade. It made the sort of screech that sets the teeth on edge.
"As a demonstration of my benevolence," Sarabian continued, "I've made arrangements for you all to be lodged here tonight, and to provide you with accommodations that will give each of you absolute privacy to review your past lives, so that you can answer questions fully tomorrow. Lord Vanyan, would you and your knights be so good as to escort our guests down to their quarters in the dungeon?"
Sarabian was improvising for all he was worth.
"At once, Your Majesty," Vanyan replied, clashing his mailed fist against his breastplate in salute.
Lord Vanyan,"
Elana added.
"Yes, my queen?"
"You might consider searching our guests before you put them to bed. We don't want any more of them hurting themselves the way the Chancellor of the Exchequer did. Now, do we?"
"Excellent suggestion, Your Majesty," Sarabian agreed. "Take all their toys away from them, Lord Vanyan. We don't want them to be distracted by anything."
He paused a moment. "Actually, Lord Vanyan, I rather think our guests will be able to concentrate a little better if they have something tangible about them to emphasize their situation. It seems that I read something once to the effect that the prisoners in Aline dungeons wear a kind of uniform."
"Yes, Your Majesty," Vanyan told him with an absolutely straight face. "It's a sleeveless smock made of gray burlap, with a bright red stripe painted down the back, so that they can be identified in case they escape.
Do you suppose we might be able to find something along those lines for our guests?
If not, we can improvise, Your Majesty.
Splendid, Lord Vanyan. And take their jewels away from them as well. Jewels make people feel important, and I want them all to understand that they're little more than bugs. I suppose you'd better feed them as well. What do people usually eat in dungeons?
Bread and water, Your Majesty. A little gruel once in a while.
That should do nicely. Get them out of here, Vanyan. The very sight of them is starting to nauseate me.
Vanyan barked a few sharp commands, and the knights descended on the former government. Each official had an honor guard of armored men to escort him, in some cases to drag him down to the dungeon.
Stay a moment, Teoven, the Emperor said urbanely to the director of the secret police. I believe there was something you wanted to say to me.
No, Your Majesty.
Teoven's tone was sullen. Come, come, old boy, don't be shy. We're all friends here. If you're in any way offended by anything I've done here today, spit it out. Milord Stragan will be happy to lend you his rapier. And then you and I can discuss things. I'm sure you'll find my explanations quite pointed.
Sarabian let his mantle slide to the floor. He smiled a chill smile and drew his rapier again.
Well, he said,
it would be treason for me to offer violence to Your Majesty's person, Teoven mumbled.
Good God, Teoven, why should that bother you? You've been involved in treason for the past several years anyway, so why concern yourself with a few picky little technicalities? Take up the sword, man. For once, just once, face me openly. I'll give you a fencing lesson, one you'll remember for the rest of your life, short though that may be.
I will not raise my hand against my emperor, Teoven declared.
What a shame. I'm really disappointed in you, old boy. You may go now.
Vanyan took the director's arm in his mailed fist and half-dragged him from the throne room. The Emperor of Tamale exultantly raised his rapier over his head, rose to his tiptoes, and spun about in a flamboyant little pirouette. Then he extended one leg forward and bowed extravagantly to Aelana, sweeping his slender sword to the side.
And that, dear mother, he said to her, is how you overthrow a government.
No, Lady Sophronia,
the queen said flatly a half hour later, when they had gathered again in the royal apartment.
You do not have our permission to withdraw. You're a member of the Royal Council of Alenia, and we have need of you.
Sophronia's pale, grief-stricken face went stiff.
As Your Majesty commands.
Snap out of it, Sophronia. This is an emergency. We don't have time for personal concerns. Zelasta's betrayed us all, not just you. Now we have to try to minimize the damage.
You're not being fair, Mother,
Danae accused.
I'm not trying to be. You'll be queen one day, Danae. Now sit down, keep your mouth shut, and learn.
Danae looked startled. Then her chin came up. She curtsied.
Yes, Your Majesty, she said. That's better. I'll make a queen of you yet.
Sir Bevier?
Yes, Your Majesty, Bevier replied.
Tell your Serenics to man their catapults. Vanyan, put the rest of the knights on the walls and tell them to start boiling the pitch. Zelasta's on the loose out there. He's completely lost control of himself, and we have no idea of what forces he has at his command. In his present state, he may try anything, so let's be ready. Just in case.
You sound like a field marshal, Aelana, Sarabian told her.
I am, she replied absently. It's one of my titles. Sparhawk, can Bellium counter any magic Zelasta might throw at us?
Easily, my queen. He probably won't try anything, though. You saw what happened to him when Bellium blew his cloud apart. It's very painful to have one of your spells broken. Sophronia knows him better than I do. She can tell you whether or not he's desperate enough to risk that again.
Well, Sophronia?
Aelana asked.
I don't really know, Your Majesty,
the small Styric woman replied after a moment's thought.
This is a side of him I've never seen before. I honestly believe he's gone mad. He might do almost anything.
We'd better be ready for him, then. Mirtai, ask Kaltan and Ulof to bring Kolata in here. Let's find out just how far this conspiracy goes.
Sparhawk drew Sophronia to one side.
How did Zelasta find out about Danae? He asked. It's obvious that he knows who she really is. Did you tell him?
No, she told me not to,
That's peculiar. I'll talk with her later and find out why. Maybe she suspected something. Or it might have been one of those hunches of hers. He thought for a moment. Could he have been trying to kill you? It seemed that he was throwing that fireball at Danny. But you might have been his target.
I could never believe that, Sparhawk.
At this point, I'm almost ready to believe anything. He hesitated. Zanisha knew about him, you realize. She told us earlier.
Why didn't you warn me?
Her tone was shocked. Because you wouldn't have believed her. You're not really inclined to trust her word, Sophronia. You had to see Zelasta's treachery for yourself. Oh, incidentally, she did save your life, you'll remember. You might want to give that some thought.
Don't scold me, Sparhawk,
she said with a wan little smile.
I'm having a difficult enough time as it is.
I know, and I'm afraid nobody can make it any easier for you.
Kolata proved to be very cooperative. His weeks of confinement had broken his spirit, and Zelasta's obvious willingness to kill him had cancelled any loyalty he might have felt.
I really don't know, he replied to Oscania's question. Teoven might, though. He's the one who brought Zelasta's proposal to me originally.
Then you haven't been involved in this affair since you were first appointed to office?
I don't think this affair, as you call it, has been going on for that long. I can't say for certain, but I got the impression that it all started about 5 or 6 years ago.
You've been recruiting people for longer than that.
That was just ordinary Tamil politics, Oscania. I knew that the Prime Minister was an idiot as soon as I took office. You were my only significant opponent. I was recruiting people to counter your moves, and your absurd idea that the subject kingdoms of Derisia are foreign nations, rather than integral parts of metropolitan Tamale.
We can discuss jurisdictional disputes some other time, Kolata. It was Teoven, then? He's been your contact with the enemy? Kolata nodded.
Teoven and a disreputable drunkard named Krager. Krager's an Eosian, and he's had dealings with Prince Sparhawk before, I understand. Everyone in our loose confederation knows him, so he makes a perfect messenger. When he's sober.
That's Krager, all right, Calton noted. What exactly did Zelasta offer you, Kolata? Oscania asked the prisoner.
Power, wealth, the usual. You're a minister of the government, Oscania. You know the game and the stakes we play for. We all thought that the Emperor was no more than a figurehead, well-meaning, a little vague, and not really very well informed.
Sorry, Your Majesty, but that's what we all believed.
Thank you, Sarabian replied. That's what you were supposed to think.
What really baffles me, though, is the fact that you all overlooked the fact that the Aetons are loyal to me personally.
Didn't any of you take that into consideration?
We underestimated, Your Majesty. We didn't think you grasped the full implications of that. If we'd thought for a moment that you really understood how much power you had, we'd have killed you.
I rather thought you might have. That's why I played the simpleton.
Did Zelasta tell you who was really behind all of this? Oscania asked.
He pretended that he was speaking for Sirgan, Kolata replied.
We didn't take that too seriously, though. Styrix are peculiar people. They always try to make us believe that they represent a higher power of some kind. They never seem to want to accept full responsibility. So far as I know, however, it was Zelasta's scheme.
I think that maybe it's time for us to hear from Zelasta himself, Vanyan said.
Have you got him hidden up your sleeve, Vanyan?
Elana asked.
In a manner of speaking, Your Majesty. Calton, why don't you take the Minister of the Interior back to his room? He looks a little tired.
I still have questions, Lord Vanyan, Oscania protested.
We'll get you your answers, old boy, Itania assured him. Quicker, and in much greater detail. You plod, Oscania. It's one of your failings. We're just going to hurry things along.
Vanyan waited until Calton and Ulof had removed Kolata from the room.
We've told you all in a general sort of way that Zanisha knows what other people are thinking. This isn't just some vague notion about feelings or moods. If she chooses, she can repeat your thoughts word for word. Most of you probably have some doubts about that. So, in the interests of saving time, why don't we have her demonstrate? Would you tell us what Queen Aelana is thinking right now, Anoray?
And it pleases thee, Lord Venion,
the Delphaic woman replied.
Her Majesty is enjoying herself very much at the moment. She is, however, discontent with thee for thine interruption. She is pleased with the progress of Emperor Sarabian, thinking it might now be reasonable to expect some small measure of competence from him. She hath as well certain designs of an intimate nature upon her husband, for political activity doth ever stir that side of her personality.
Aelana's face turned bright red.
You stop that at once, she exclaimed.
I'm sorry, Your Majesty, Venion apologized. I didn't anticipate that last bit. Did Zanisha more or less read your thoughts correctly?
You know I won't answer that, Venion.
The Queen's face was still flaming.
Will you at least concede that she has access to the thoughts of others?
I'd heard about that, Sarabian mused. I thought it was just another of the wild stories we hear about the Delphae.
Belium confirmed it, Emperor Sarabian, Sparhawk told him. Zanisha can read others the way you'd read an open book. I'd imagine that she's read Zelasta from cover to cover. She should be able to tell us everything we want to know. He looked at Zanisha. Could you give us a sort of summary of Zelasta's life, Anoray? He asked her. Sophrenia, in particular, is deeply saddened by what he revealed in the throne room. Maybe if she knows the reasons for his actions, she'll find them easier to understand.
I can speak for myself, Sparhawk, Sophrenia told him tartly.
I'm sure you can, little mother. I was just serving as an intermediary. You and Zanisha don't get on too well.
What's this? Sarabian asked quickly.
An ancient enmity, Your Majesty,
Zanisha explained.
So ancient, in truth, that none living knoweth its source.
I know, Sophrenia grated at her, and it's not as ancient as all that.
Perhaps, but hearken unto the mind of Zelasta, and judge for thyself, Sophrenia of Ilara.
Colton and Uloth returned, and quietly took their seats again.
Zelasta was born some few centuries ago in the Styric village of Ilara, which lay in the forest near Sene in northern Astel.
Zanisha began.
In his seventh year was there born also in that selfsame village she whom we know as Sophrenia, one of the thousand of Styricum, tutor to the Pandian knights in the secrets of Styricum, counselor of Alenia, and beloved of Preceptor Venion.
That's no longer true, Sophrenia said shortly.
I spoke of Lord Venion's feelings for thee, Sophrenia, not of thine for him. Zelasta's family was on friendly terms with Sophrenia's, and they did conclude between them that when Sophrenia and Zelasta should reach a suitable age, they would be wed.
I'd forgotten about that, Sophrenia said suddenly. I've never really thought of him that way.
It hath been the central fact of his life, however, I do assure thee. When thou wert in thy ninth year, didst thy mother conceive, and the child she bore was in truth Aphriel, child goddess of Styricum, and in the instant of her birth did Zelasta's hopes and dreams turn to dust and ashes, for thy life was forever given over entirely to thine infant sister. Zelasta's wrath knew no bounds, and he did hide himself in the forest, lest his countenance betray his innermost thoughts. Much he travelled, seeking out the most powerful magicians of Styricum, even at peril of his soul, those outcast and accursed. His search had but one aim, to discover some means whereby a man might overthrow and destroy a god, for his despair drove him to an unreasoning hatred of the child goddess, and, more than anything, he sought her death.
Princess Danae gasped aloud.
"You're supposed to be listening,"
her mother said.
"I was startled, Mother."
"You must never show that. Always keep your emotions under control."
"Yes, Mother." "It was in the 6th year of the life of the child goddess, in that particular incarnation, that Celasta, in a frenzy of frustration, since all with whom he had spoken had told him that his goal was beyond human capability, turned to more direct means, hoping perhaps that the child goddess might be caught unawares, or that by reason of her tender years might she not yet have come into her full powers. Conceived he a reckless plan, an attempt to overwhelm her with sheer numbers. Though the goddess herself is immortal, thought he that mayhap might her incarnation be slain, forcing her to seek another vessel for her awareness."
"Would that work?" Colton asked Sparhawk. "How should I know?"
Sparhawk threw a guarded glance at his daughter. Danae very casually shook her head.
"In furtherance of his hasty and ill-conceived scheme, did Celasta assume the guise of an Aline clergyman, and did visit the rude villages of the serfs of that region, and did denounce the Styrix of his own village, describing them as idolaters and demon-worshippers, whose foul rites demanded the blood of Aline virgins. So hotly did he inflame them with his false reports, that on a certain day did the ignorant serfs gather, and swept they down upon that innocent Styric village, slaughtering all, and putting their houses to the torch."
"But that was Sophrenia's home, too," Elana exclaimed.
"How could he be sure that she wouldn't be killed as well?" "He was beyond caring, Queen of Alenia. Indeed, it was his thought that better far should she die than that Afriel should have her. Better a grief that would pass than endless, unsatisfied longing. But as it came to pass, the child goddess had besought her sister that very morning that they two should go into the forest to gather wildflowers. And thus it was that they were not there when the Aline serfs fell upon the village."
"Zelasta told me the story once," Sparhawk interrupted. "He said that he was with Sophrenia and Afriel in the forest."
"Nay, Annika, he was at the village, directing the search for the two."
"Why would he lie about something like that?"
"Mayhap he doth lie even to himself. His acts that day were monstrous, and it is in our nature to obscure such behavior from ourselves."
"Maybe that's it," he conceded.
"He may well perceive the depths of Zelasta's hatred and despair, when thou knowest that his own kindred perished there,"
Zanisha continued.
"Yea, his father and his mother and sisters three fell beneath the cudgels and scythes of the ravening beasts he had unleashed, even as he looked on."
"I don't believe you," Sophrenia burst out. End of Side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.